Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, guys. Got a episode here that's dear to my heart. I've got Lee Ross, law enforcement, and we're going to talk about Lee's life story and the current status of law enforcement. First, Lee Ross, that's a very, very Southern name. Any roots there? Where were you born?
No, I was just given three first names after my grandfather. My dad just was traditional about it, just Lee Edward Ross. People call me Lee, call me Ross, call me him. They're all first names.
So, where were you born?
So I was born in Oklahoma City. Back in the 80s baby. And then kind of grew up mostly in Oklahoma, moved around a little bit in high school, and ended up moving to Texas for a little while, and then moved back to Oklahoma and graduated and started like my professional career of growing up and being an adult. It's kind of where it all began, I guess.
Started with the Marine Corps.
Yes. So I was not prepared for college, like a lot of probably kids are. And then it was like all of a sudden your senior year's there and I wasn't ready. And it was kind of like that embarrassment of like, I don't know where I'm going. And so Marine Corps was always something I wanted to do, thought I could be a pilot, but I don't add very well, like a lot of Marines. So I ended up listening and going to the reserves, which actually is kind of twofold. Like you have, you know, Marines and Reserve Marines, and there's all like that inter-service rivalry within the service of it. But it was a blessing because I wanted to be an infantry Marine in Broken Arrow is a tow company for 0352s or tow missilemen. And they serve all 9 infantry battalions out of that one company. So it's an entire company of these guys. And then, so whenever they go to AT or they go in deployment, they would then move out to wherever their infantry battalion is. I was 3rd Battalion, 23rd Marines. So our weapons company was out of Baton Rouge. So a lot of good Cajun boys coming from there for the weapons company, great machine gunners, trust them with a lot of things, gumbo as well. But, it's kind of how it was, and it was a great experience for what it was. It fit my life well, and it hit at opportune times.
Trying to think of all the guys I served with from Louisiana, but only one really comes to mind. His name was Morphus. Grew up on a ranch in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Big boy, handsome dude. Oh, the draw was bad. Sometimes you couldn't understand him, but that guy was a fighter.
There was a couple guys, you needed some subtitles to understand what it was that they were saying. But a lot of them were mostly LSU students. Like they were in Baton Rouge at the time. And one reason or another, they're, you know, third year in, they're like, I just joined the Marine Corps, I want to be a machine gunner for one day. And then back in school, and then they're in law school, and then they're in business school, you know, as a Lance Corporal, which is like the oddness that is the reserve Marines that, when the active duty components come in, they're not used to that. Mm-hmm. You know, they're used to 19-year-old Lance Corporals and,
yes,
you know, 20-year-old Corporals and, you know, being 19 and 20-year-old young men. And then you have a Lance Corporal who's 27 and a lawyer, but now he's, you know, on deployment because that's what he has to do and stuff. So it was a unique experience for what it is and kind of really like showcased how valuable a reserve component can be in theater. In there. So a lot of great lessons. When we finally deployed, was at the tail end of the surge, so there really wasn't much to do as far as
08, 09?
Yeah, 07 to 08. So it was right at the tail end. So we were deployed with to the Haditha Triad region. So there's the dam in Haditha, and you got, you know, the Tri-City area, and pretty much the birthplace of civilization right there on the Euphrates. So it was really, really cool if you're a history nerd like I am. But being as in, like, there was really no anti-armor threat, they really didn't have a job for us. So we have a whole platoon of, you know, tow missilemen. Like, what are we going to do? We're great with vehicles because we work with vehicles all the time. So convoy ops was our deal.
Yes.
We ended up getting snagged by the battalion commander, who was then, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Bellin, who's now, he's about to retire, but he's the current Mar 4 Res commander right now. Super great guy. And we just kind of took him from point A to point B everywhere. So it was a real unique experience from if you're going to be in a, you know, non-kinetic theater for being everything that it was up till then, it really kind of showcased the other half of warfighting with, mm-hmm. you know, that you really understand, like, the non-kinetic movements of the chessboard and the pieces and infrastructure mm-hmm. and how important that is. And really, I just got a front row seat to that. And then rather than me and, you know, like a lot of the Marines, they were stuck in there, you know, their COPs or the EPBs and, you know, had to do their, you know, their local patrols. We got to go to Fallujah and we got to go to Baghdad and we got to, you know, see different dignitaries and lead different things and get a real detached overall view of like
a master class.
Yeah. Just in the whole 7 months of just what it's in there. And so the colonel, he's really open about like what it is we're doing, but then he was real private when he needed to be. He measured that really well, which is kind of hard to do when you work with people every day. You can lose that professionalism of what is the discipline of what we think of as the military and the Marine Corps, you know, because at the end of the day, we're just humans. But we made it work, and it was a really great experience for what it was. Like the only cool thing we ever did, like I ride home is, or I tell people about is we got a late night call. Colonel walks in the weight room. He's like, "Hey, I need you to get staff sergeant. We're going on a thing right now." Okay, I got the boys together. I'm going ready. Next thing, it's like a big to-do deal, and we're going to this place where we've been several times. And then halfway out there, we're going to stop. Some people are going to come and meet us up there. But like next thing, all I see is IR lights out of the sky. Like I don't hear anything. Like there's a bunch of wind. Next thing you know, it's just a dust cloud and a bunch of dudes, a dog, and their own prisoner. Everyone's named Mike. Like for me, like coming back in the fast forward in police work, and you get people like in the tactical world, and start calling themselves operators. I'm like, if you did not fly in on a helicopter that didn't make noise and your name's not Mike, you're not an operator. That's like your standard, like to me, because these guys come off and they're like, "Hey, like I'm Mike, we're just here to do stuff," and just totally legit guys and there for a purpose. And you know, they have little on their forearm, iPad, real time. I thought it was cool because I had a map, you know, not, you know, at certain levels, you get the NCO, you get your little green book, you know, you're important then.
Yes.
So then when you get a map, you feel even more important, then you feel insignificant because it's not digital. You know, it's before iPads and, you know, iPods are like really a huge deal at the time. So that was probably like the coolest thing we did as far as like operationally, because you just meet these guys and they came into their thing and then more helicopters came in. They didn't make noise and they left, and it was it. Just a thing. It was in there.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they were nice.
No.
Respectful.
Really great dudes.
There you go.
Really helpful.
Like, that's what I love. When guys like that are complete dicks, it really rubbed me raw. I mean, we were always highly respectful and kind of everyone we worked with, regardless of your rank, what you did in the military. That is a good theory in life. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, I say it, be careful on the way up. Because you're going to see the same people on the way down. And how you treated them on the way up, they're mm-hmm. going to remember that when you reach out for help. But as cool as those guys are, it was usually the Marine Corps or Army had to come get them out in really bad situations. Bottom line, even 30 guys with 4 mags each can only sustain for so long. The reserves, I always thought that was a good deal, especially for like the Special Forces groups.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in the Army. But those guys that were special forces at the height of the war in the reserve groups, they'd be like, "Yeah, dude, I can just activate and go with, you know, 5th group over there or 7th group or 3rd group and basically attach on as a strap hanger and serve my role." But then even at, like, I met some guys in the JSOC world that were mm-hmm. SF reserve and just screened and made it into JSOC and just activated. And great dudes, man. Smart.
Yeah, JSOC was just beginning, like, in that time period, because it was just recon Marines are in there, and you had to go through the indoc process. And what a lot of people don't understand about the reserves, like, you're limited to, like, your geographical area of what's available. And so, like, there's a lot of guys in Alaska and in San Antonio because that's where the recon battalions are for the reserves. Or, you know, so, like, if you're not there, you got to make a contract to travel to those places.
Yes. And, yes.
You know, but once you get those, you know, you come from active duty, you have those calls, like, you can be a strap player, and, like, your world's limitless because there's always needing people. Like, there's no shortage of needing good people.
You know, you said something earlier, I'm going way back here, which is, like, I'm told as a no-no in podcasts, but fuck it. It's my podcast. You said you weren't prepared for college. You know, nor was I. I think my parents had the financial resources to send me, and I pissed that money away. And before my dad could get my hands on me, I withdrew from all my classes because I
had to be a little bit of fun.
I raged and attended very few classes, and I skied my ass off. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of kids that go to college that aren't prepared for college either. I'm a fan of kids should go work for 4 years before they go back to college. If kids, one, they're going to gain a lot of life experience, a lot of maturity. They're going to understand having to pay for their bills. But if you started as a freshman at 22, and this was basically for the Marine Corps. I mean, I joined the Marine Corps after a very short stint in college, went back at, how old was I? I was 23 when I went back to college, finished, you know, one, I was a Marine, finished in 3 years with a 3.7 GPA. I got a 2.9 in high school and didn't even graduate with my senior class. I'm a big fan of that. And I know General McChrystal's actually advocated for kids going to do, like, mandatory government service, whether it's military or some part of the federal government, also to spur on, a little bit of nationalism in a good way, love for country, while paying it back. But there's a lot of kids that just get to go to college and just slide by, and their parents have the financial resources to do it.
Well, I think some, like, kids benefiting now and making more successful in school are things that you and I didn't get to benefit from, like, which, you know, No Child Left Behind, that put a lot of resources and funding into schools to help with, like, a lot of identifying learning disabilities, where you and I, it was, well, you're not paying attention enough.
Yeah, like, no, I want to be outside. I want to go drink. I want to go party. I want to go, like, surf, all jump off a bridge.
So, like, when it's a maturity, like, some of these things you can grow out. And when you get professionalism, you see, okay, here's my drive. You know, that's what I needed in here. But, like, a lot of the kids, like, they're like, hey, actually, you're dyslexic. That's why you don't enjoy reading. That's why you listen really well. But that's not what is good for the school environment, for what it was at the time. And I just wasn't, like, the straight A student kid and thing. I didn't get in a lot of trouble or anything, but it was just like, I was not your A plus guy. Like, don't copy off my test. You know, it was just kind of one of those things. I was just a mediocre and in the middle. I wasn't super successful. I wasn't bad. So I was just in that group, like, hey, you're graduating. Like, I kind of conned my way through it.
It wasn't a lack of aptitude or intelligence. It was just, you weren't focused, nor was I. Yeah. And I'll say it, the Marine Corps does a very good job of taking an 18-year-old boy or girl off the streets and turning them into a man or woman. And you have to be a professional soldier, or you're going to have a real rough time in the Marines or the military for a whole. But at what point did you decide law enforcement was the route you wanted to go?
Yeah, you know, I think it was really crafted from the Marine Corps in that, like, just sense of purpose. And I think what I had not had, and what the Marine Corps is so great about, when is its infrastructure and building its culture. Like, it's, I think that's what separates it from a lot of the other services, is, you know, they call, like, you know, the cult building, and, you know, read these other, you know, listen to other guys in other services, like, you guys are just a different breed. You guys are just in here, and, like, what it is. And what I think really what it is, from day one, when you get there, it is impounded upon you, like, this was made by someone else giving their life for, like, don't take it lightly. And that's every day in there, in the history. And, you know, like, when you go through the crucible, every event is after a Medal of Honor recipient, you know, Navy Cross recipient at minimum, you know, and you just hear these things that they've done. And like, that's what is always on your shoulders, of just, you're not going to let that down. Like, this is the heritage that you bring. And so that really shaped a lot of my professionalism and just follow through and understanding, like, say what you're going to do and, you know,
do what you're going to say.
Yeah. Like, if that's, you know, what you want out of, you know, not just professionals, but just out of good human beings. And creating that and giving them chance to, you know, to fail forward and mentor and craft. That's what I think has been excellent about the Marine Corps, which, you know, shaped me into that. But then, you know, you get out of the Marines, especially as an infantryman, there's a lot of stereotypes. Like, you're just going to do what you're told. Like, you touched on that, like, in your books, and, you know, a lot of other authors have too. It's just like, you're going to do what you say because you're in the military and that's what you do. Take orders. You're like, yeah, well, we're also a thinker.
Yeah.
You know, that's not how it works. And that was a really big adjustment when I came back from deployment, because that's when I went back to school and was doing better. Like, I was actually serious and I was able to, okay, here's a craft. Here's where a direction where I need to go. And it wasn't an obstacle anymore. It was a stepping stone. And, you know, I was working as a civilian at a, you know, university police department, locking doors, like nothing awesome at all. And especially you go from fighting a war and leading Marines in combat patrols, and then I hear you're just locking doors on a university.
Yeah.
And, like, they want you to write the university ticket. And it's like, I was like,
that's a tough transition.
But it was humbling. It just allowed me to go to school and just get in the path. But getting back in 2008, that's, like, right when the recession happened, so no one's hiring. You know, I had this trajectory. I was going to work for the Oklahoma City Police Department. A family went there. I wanted to go, like, I had it in there, and it didn't work out for me. So it's like, now what? You know, now what are you going to do? Are you going to give up? Like, is that who you are? Are you a quitter? And, you know, so I was like, no, I'm better than that. Like, there's other people and other opportunities. But it just really transitioned into one of the reasons why I love being a Marine, is that I had an opportunity to defend those who can't defend themselves. You know, you see that a lot, you know, especially when you go on deployments, you know, like, you're like, why am I here? Why am I doing this? And you'll see that small town farmer girl who has nothing. They live on a dirt floor, but she's got carrots and she's offering some of those carrots to you because you just that wholesomeness. And you're like, okay, this is why. Because there's people who want to hurt her, and I'm not going to let that happen if I have that opportunity. And it happens here too. And so it's kind of just carrying that same thing, that service into it.
It happens here more often than it happens over there. And that's what people get wrong is, yeah, we faced evil over there, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of fun to eradicate the evil. And that doesn't make me a, you know, psychopath. Wow. There was a sense of purpose behind it. And I don't know why we shielded the American public from some of the videos that were recovered from direct action raids, mm-hmm. of the atrocities, much like October 7. Mm-hmm. That the public should see that. The public should see that, and anyone who wants to be anti-Israel,
yeah.
would, if they're a decent person, probably reevaluate their stance.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of evil from human trafficking, you know, child trafficking in this this nation, to drug peddlers, to just rapists. I mean, it's, yeah. We are in scary times, my friend. We are in very scary times.
Mm-hmm.
How was going through the police academy? Was that, I'm sure the one that's, it's very academic.
So it is my personal experience. So I ended up, don't judge me. Okay. But so my first cop job was at the University of Oklahoma. I understand you're a UT fan. It is, we're in neutral territory. We're fun. I get it.
A parochial school. Got
yeah.
It.
Got, joking, you know, it is the university, by the way. Yeah, you know,
what do you say to that, Will? You better get out of our state. You better go back to Oklahoma.
Yeah, I don't know. I love Texas, though. Like, that's the thing. But it is, you know, it was a stepping stone. It wasn't where I wanted to be, but it was the opportunity I needed to be humbled and put in there, because I was like, Oklahoma City runs a very tough, rigorous training program, and I knew about it, and I wanted that. I wanted tough. And then it didn't work out for me there. So then for anyone who can't run their own program in that state, they go to a state academy, and it's all in Ada, Oklahoma. And it's the bare minimum. It's not what you desire. And it's like, when you find out that some of these guys are chiefs in their towns, and it's like, this is even more scary. Like, it's rough. And so, You know, so there's like a lot of that self-drive. You have to hold yourself to a higher standard. And then you learn the basic bare minimum there. And it's not challenging. It's just, can you take in information and apply it? And then the hardest part was really coming to realize that there's a difference between defending the Constitution and then working within the Constitution. Because when they wrote that thing, like, they knew what they were doing. Like, they made it tough. And so, like, when you go to have those interactions as the government to a citizen, and you're like, well, I don't know if I can't do that. And then you realize, like, how tough it is to, like, just to almost even communicate in some aspects. And so it really makes you, becomes a thinking man's game or woman's game. And so that was tough, and just basic concepts of just barely touching into. They want you to be legal scholars, but
yes,
you got 12 weeks, you know, at this point. And then if you're lucky, you got your own agency would have an extended training program for, you know, liability purposes and things that you want, if they're organized, right, and they're accredited and they know what's going on.
And I was going to ask that. So you continue to
it's ever pile evolving into
legal. Constitutional rights.
Every time a case is decided, things come down, like what you could do one day. Learned. Yeah, well, what you could do one day, you can't do the next, because mm-hmm. now this decision came out. Like a small thing is in 2013, 2014, SCOTUS or Supreme Court ruled that, you know, searching someone's phone incident to arrest is no longer allowed because they hold so much more data than what they used to. It's not just messages. It's, you know, all kinds of personal effects. And whereas before is like before they were, you know, put into jail, you could go through their phone. You could look at their messages. Like there was a lot of information you would get from drug dealers. You'd arrest them on a valid charge and then go through their phone. You'd be like, okay, well, cool. Here's a phone number we now need to pay more attention to. And then that ruling came out. Okay, well, you can't do that anymore. And so now it's like, what is the way that we can do that? And a lot of people, they get upset. Well, SCOTUS, they take this away. I was like, well, no, it's what it's intended for. Like, that's the Constitution at work. Like, as the times evolves, we have to evolve with it. But so I ended up coming down to, I didn't want to stay at OU for the rest of my life. It just wasn't the type of plea. Yeah. I learned a lot. I mm-hmm. learned a whole different level, a whole different demographic. Ended up taking an opportunity lateral to the Irving Police Department in Irving, Texas. Thought I was really impressed to really run fiscally well. Just the culture at the time of what they were wanting to do just wasn't consistent with my beliefs as a person. And just mm-hmm. kind of, if you worked hard and you caused problems, like you were given problems. And that was just kind of like not what I signed up for. Like I was just doing things with good intent, what I thought was aggressive policing that was within the rules and within the confines. But then I felt like I was constantly being told, like, hey, well, you know, you're not doing it right the way I see it. And that's when you start getting into like that, well, what's the rule? Like, what's the standard? And then are we going to hold to that standard? And then you just see who's going to get promoted around you. And then you're like, okay, you know, this isn't for me anymore. And you know, you make changes and that's.
I've got to assume there's a lot more politics within promotions within law enforcement than there is the military.
So in some agencies, yeah, like sheriff's departments can be really politicky, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. because it's an elected office and things where, in Texas is really great with Civil Service Commission. And it's like, there's a standard, like there's a set way by law, how it has to be conducted and all the rules right there. Like it's not a, you know, hide and seek game to anyone. So basically boils down to a written test that's in there. Yes. And you can get certain points yes. for veteran status and stuff. And so a lot of people study hard for there, which breeds its own problems, but you know, it's at least some sort of a fair metric that people can use. So that's how a lot of departments are as far as like those types of promotions. But when it comes to appointments is where it gets real politicky because the chief can appoint technically whoever he wants. Like mm-hmm. he's the chief. Mm-hmm. And that's where you start seeing some Game of Thrones stuff start yeah, happening, right. you know, for people.
I think that's any organization. Do cops, police officers roll their eyes? Sheriffs sometimes like, oh, here we go.
I don't see it. Like, we don't really see our sheriff's deputies much, you know, yeah. it's because, well, I mean, where I'm at is just, we do with like the warrant squads and stuff because mm-hmm. they'll ask for like any help, but like, we really don't see a lot of them. But they're more in the rural areas, but you know, like the city of Fort Worth spans five counties, yep. you know, and they're you know, like
12th largest city in the nation, correct?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It was.
That shocked me. I had no idea.
Yeah. It's expansive. Like they can't build fast enough, dude. It's insane. Texas. Yeah.
Thanks everyone. To all those Californians and New Yorkers.
Yeah, everyone coming around.
Stay in your state. Per capita, do you think guys coming out of the military do a lot better as police officers?
So I like to get one of the passions like getting into law enforcement was, you know, creating your successor, you know, and you can't complain about the generation coming after you if you're not willing to invest yourself into them.
Damn straight.
So training was my big thing that I like to do, but stay relevant. And, you know, like if they're failing, then it's because I failed to teach them. And so that was a big thing into it. And so when I started diving more into the training aspect, prior service was great because you didn't have to deal with the why are they telling me what to do. They're like, okay, they're in charge for right now. And, you know, this is what you do. It's just part of it. Like the threat of why is a lot less there to a point. But where it gets really hard is that sometimes they can have that active aggressive, you know, bias for action, which is awesome and creates situations. But then that's where you really have to talk to them like, hey, you took an oath to defend the Constitution in this area. But now here we have to not defend it, but we also have to work
within
it.
We have different constraints.
Like, yeah. So it's really teaching that concept that gets tough because in the military we think like, okay, hey, I can go do this just because. And it's, you know, it's much different. That's why there's the, you know, the UCMJ versus the regular law. You know, they create new rules for it because they can circumvent certain things in that environment. And so just that's where you start really trying to teach them like, hey, how much can we learn about the problem and figure out without fighting? Because we win 100% of the fights we don't fight. So, you know, before we have the conflict, does it even have to take place? Mm-hmm. Or are there, you know, non-kinetic movements that we can...
How can we de-escalate this, which is, I know, always a priority for you guys. So, huge fan of law enforcement. Got police officers within our families. My grandfather was a lead detective in San Francisco. Yeah. Got a cousin who's on the SFPD, Oakland PD. Right now. Yeah. Somebody reached out and they're like, hey, would you come talk to a group of San Francisco PD? And it was... pretty recent. I'm like, I don't know what I would say to him. I honestly, I'd probably come in and be like, hey, you guys need to contact local PDs in Texas and get the hell out of this city. Because anything I would tell them, I couldn't in good conscience, like keep a straight face. In our family's been in San Francisco since 1899. Beautiful city.
Beautiful.
It is a disaster by design right now. And bad leadership equals bad policies, which equal bad outcomes. And the fact that I texted my dad when I saw San Francisco at one point, and I don't know if they moved forward with this, we're going to pay criminals $500 a month
to not commit crime. But all you're doing is just any entrepreneur sees like, and I got $500 operating expenses.
I'm like, hey, how do I like register within San Francisco as a, how do I get that $500?
Yeah, no, it is. I think nationally, when we talk about law enforcement, like what is the problem is there is that we've already started complicating the issue because many people don't understand police departments are locally funded. You know, 90 to 95% of, you know, police departments are funded by the local populace that's in there. So like the national trends aren't there. So it's like, what is more important to your area? And that's kind of what makes policing so intimate is that, you know, there is no one size fits all. Like there's the general sizes of the confines that we have to do and we can restrict and do that. But like your tribe, basically like your culture gets to decide whether or not
you're funded.
This is accepted.
Yes.
You know, like, is this behavior going to be allowed? And that's kind of what we've seen in you know, other areas where, it's kind of like, you know, in Seattle for all the problems like those officers having to deal with. But like when they had the whole Chad incident, that's weird. Like they by not doing anything, they allowed, you know, someone trying to secede a portion of Seattle as their own place. And the first thing they did was erect barriers and checkpoints, things that they were absolutely against. And it's like, you know, where or how long are we going to allow this problem to fester? Are we going into how like when does de-escalation become an escalating problem? And then, so it's a difficult thing.
It's less de-escalation. It's more pandering.
I'm sorry.
It's more pandering. Let's step back.
Yes, sir.
The George Floyd incident
Yeah,
was catastrophic to law enforcement across the nation.
That was a rough summer.
It's tragic what happened. Mm-hmm. Are there bad Marines in the Marine Corps?
Absolutely.
100%. Navy, Army, no. Air Force. No, I don't know anything about Space Force, so I couldn't tell you. Bad things happen. There are rotten apples in any organization.
Yeah.
And I hate when people paint with broad brush strokes. Mm-hmm. And even a family member of ours posted something that said, was all cops are bad, whatever the acronym is. Mm-hmm. And my wife had an allergic reaction to that. And I did too. And I'm like, hey, I'm not even going to pay credence. So, you know, again, coming from the military, always had a high degree of respect for law enforcement, firefighters. Anyone who runs towards a burning building has my respect. It's like if you had a bomb, you're like, EOD guy up, we'll be 200 meters out. Yeah. Let us know how it goes.
Yeah.
But that was catastrophic. The media did not help. You had the Black Lives Matter, which was very anti-law enforcement. Recruiting is down. And cops are leaving in groves. And I don't blame them. I've said it publicly. I don't know why anyone would join law enforcement these days. Because the cards are already stacked against you. You can't win. Even when you do your job, somebody has a cell phone that's out. And it's how they chop that video, how they send it in, or only get the portion where you're going fisticuffs with a perp. And you're in the wrong. And they don't have the context. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you guys feel like you've been criminalized in a sense?
No, I think where I work right now is probably one of the most pro-policing
communities.
I mean, as it's just they're just pro being good people and supporting good people. Like, you know, what happened with George Floyd in Minneapolis and that, the whole thing was tough and tragedy. And there's a lot of things that probably could have been done better, but they didn't allow the process to work for what it was on how it was in there. A lot of emotion. And I think that race is one of those things it's easy to get emotional behind. You know, our country has been very divisive in that and very key points of our, you know, structure and building and things that we've gone through. And like, I don't know one police officer who's like, yeah, let's go be racist today. Like, that's, if anything, that's like the one thing like we would all root out. Like, no one wants to get out a bad cop more than a good cop. And so dealing kind of with someone with that, you know, that was tough. People were emotional. And I totally got it. Like, they were upset. They were mad. And there was some things that came up, and it all came in at one point with COVID and people not having jobs. They had free time. And then when you have free time, like, especially now the summers, a lot of education people are in there. And, you know, it's really easy to get behind. And I understood it. I empathized with it. But I also didn't pay for almost a single lunch that whole 2 months we were, you know, dealing with our issues in our area there's times where people are like, hey, I want to buy this meal. And someone's like, no, like four people ago paid for it. And so like, that's how you really know, like you're being supported and you're out there. And even in like the clashes like we had, it was just, people were upset. They wanted better. They wanted a better standard for it. And you can't blame anyone for wanting better. And I mean, that's how we get better. But like, it also wasn't what was happening in our area. But Fort Worth has had its own turmoils and things to get through. And the only way we've continued to get better, and you know, I was a really big advocate after some key incidents happened, is like, we got to have tough conversations and we got to be willing to look people in the eye and say, hey, you know, we can agree to disagree, you know. But I don't think BLM was so much an anti-cop thing, but it was just people just wanted to be heard and respected and felt, you know. I have personal disagreements with the way that, you know, some of the viewpoints got put across. In that, I feel like, you know, going back to, I feel like there's really good people in the BLM movement. And then there were some people who really took advantage of, especially when I got to the donations and monies and misappropriations of the donated funds and stuff. And that's just sad, you know, and the whole thing that came out of it. But would be the bigger tragedy is if we don't learn from it so we can be better in the future. You know, it's kind of like, what's the long play here? Like, here's the problem. Like, are we going to worry about what happened yesterday? Or are we going to try and figure out what's going to be better for tomorrow? And that's how in Fort Worth, how I really think we got better. And it was just having those, being able to take the time to have the conversation, you know, policing was for a long time was ask, tell, make. I mean, that was a training. Like, you're going to ask him, then you're going to tell him, and you're going to make him. And that was like it. And if you didn't do that, like in the culture, it was like you can't handle your business. But then it's like, hey, I'm like, maybe take a second and like say, hey, like, and explain why. I'm like, that's a very normal human thing. But for so long, it was like, no, you're going to ask him, you're going to tell him, you're going to make it. And it's like that, it definitely has its place, especially when situations turn kinetic and, you know, you don't have the luxury of time. Like, that's a total give out. So it has its place. But I think that if we're going to want, you know, the better benefits and the better pay, then we need to step up to a better standard. And that's just like, we can't say we want more, we need to be compensated more, but we're not willing to improve. Like, that's just asinine. And so that's where, like, it goes back into the training academy. And then what are we injecting into our youth? And are we projecting what it is that we want, which goes back into who are we hiring? You know, like, yeah, that's a great question. Like, who would want to be a cop? Like, you really got to be a person who cares right now. Purpose. If you want to be a cop. Like, you got to care. More than anything, you got to care. And then you not give up and, like, undersee it. And you see the fruits of your labor. Like, you get in your good first chase, and you put that case together. You get your guy, you do this, or you really help that victim, and you get it. Like, it's rewarding. It's addicting. And, you know, and, like, when you see, like, in there for, like, all the 99 calls that you get, they're like, oh, this is annoying. When you get that 100th one, and it's in it, and you really saved a life, you made a difference, and you're like, wow.
That, like, fills the soul.
Oh, yeah, and it does, and it gets purpose-driven. And then once you start seeing, like, oh, okay, so, like, if we just continue to do it the way we always done, we're not going to improve. Like, what resource can we do now? And, you know, Chief Brown, I think he's in Chicago now. He used to be over Dallas. And when he was making his exit out of Dallas, you know, there's a lot of, you know, things that he ran his police department that I didn't personally agree with. But when he made a speech afterwards, like, you know, at the end of it, what I really agreed with is, like, you know, police are being called for things that aren't police problems. Like, you're having a mental health episode, and call the police. Your kid's not listening to you, call the police. And he was like, that's, you know, there's not enough of us. We're hiring. Like, if you don't like what you're getting, like, we're hiring. Like, you can either put up or shut up. And so I really agreed with that. And that's kind of like where you challenge and you put that back on the community. Like, if you want these changes, you got to invest in with it. And that comes in multi-phases. It doesn't mean that, you know, you have to go work for the police department, but there's, you know, I found a lot of resources is like, hey, here's a nonprofit you can work with. You know, you're having issues with, you know, job hunting or your basic needs getting met. Here's these other city resources that are funded. And then a lot of cities, I don't think, take advantage of enacting like a half-cent sales tax. Like, and I'm not a proponent of adding taxes, but what has allowed Fort Worth to be so successful in, we have what's called the CCPD, and I can't name out what it is, but basically it's a half-cent sales tax that goes towards public safety training gear funding. So every recruit that we hire is paid through this half-cent sales
tax. That's a tax I can get behind. Yeah, because you know where it's going.
Yeah, you know where it's going, but it's not just for, if you drive through and you buy gas, that person's doing it. And so we have an influx of up to 3 million people that travel through Fort Worth daily. So every purchase that's made in any, like, a part of that goes in there. And it's a pretty good revenue thing. A few years ago when I was on the budget committee, and you're hearing how, what's the income of CCPD? And you know, in this revenue, or in this quarter, we're revenue like around $115 million. You know, it's not all just to police and fire for equipment, and, you know, we're not buying Bearcats and machine guns with it, but it's a lot of this is also like, what are some of the social programs for victims assistance? You know, what about youth programs like for that can help bring structure to that family home? There's a program, a commander who I worked really close with. He's the commander of our East Division now. It's called Handle with Care. And basically what it is just a form of notification that if, you know, you have to, if you make an arrest, if you're forced to make an arrest, and it can be any sort of something, you know, whether it's use of force or it was just a bad domestic and a child is around, like, you know, just because children are there, like, they don't ever get to escape it, that you can fill out this form, and then that there's intervention counselors in the school system and in the community that, like, okay, we know that this is up. Now they're able to intervene at school, because problems that I think we really overlooked was, you know, the chaos that they're coming at, you know, with their home, and then they come into school and they're acting out on it. And it's like, where's their sanctuary? Yeah. And it's really, it's really taken off. I got a lot of help with the state legislature recently and to be broadened out. But I mean, it's simple things like that. Like, that's also what it goes to fund. It doesn't just buy, you know, SWAT gear and equipment. Like, it helps, but it's not all that it goes to. And I think a lot of cities can take advantage of something simple like that to fund some of those funding shortfalls. Like here in Austin, like, they eliminated a recruit class like that was almost finished. And then now they're trying to be incentives to make up for this gap. You know, it's manpower is a tough, tough problem. And it's 18 months minimum to get your bare basic police officer.
You know, a great lesson from the Vietnam War. And who was I talking to? I was talking to a Vietnam vet. And he basically said I was somewhat infuriated and also jealous of our generation that we came home to a welcoming, thankful nation. But for the listeners, the viewers, I don't miss an opportunity if I'm walking by a police officer or a fireman to say, hey, thank you for what you do. Mm-hmm. That simple phrase, thank you for what you do, can fill their cup for a day, maybe a week. Mm-hmm. Now, if everyone was doing that and getting behind their law enforcement, I think, you know, that doesn't solve a lot of problems, but they know they've got the support of the populace. We are in a time where just an illogical time. We are cutting you guys off the knees, and it's not necessarily Texas, but I'll use my home state, California. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a Californian in exile in Texas. I now tell people I was
there's
born
a,
in.
There's a lot.
I tell people I was born in Frisco.
Yeah.
Will reminds me I'm not. But I actually did go to two Texas universities. He only went to a private. He went to Baylor. He went to a private school. That doesn't even count. Is these policies of they can steal up to $1,000 of goods and basically walk away. Oh, yeah. These mass looting scenarios where they just, these kids rush an Apple store, they rush a convenience store. It comes down to behavior, and we all know this. We know this well in the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. You either incentivize good behaviors or you disincentivize bad behaviors. And we are incentivizing that. It is okay to commit crimes to a certain level and it will not be prosecuted.
Yeah, that's the, like, that's, I think it's a really key point. Like, it's a three-prong approach. Like, you have police interaction, and then you have the, you know, the district attorney's interpretation of what they're going to enforce and how they're going to prosecute it and the rules of evidence and things that they're going to go through. And then you have judges who will set low bonds for, you know, repeat offenders.
That kills me, man.
That's a thing. It's like, judges can't, they're immune. Like, you can't, you know, there's not really much you can do. And anytime you ever ask, is there anything you do? Like, no, they're a judge. Like, that's literally the response of any, you know, attorney I've ever had. Anything. But, like, Dallas had a problem with it, that the DA who had taken over, I forget his name, he came in office. He's like, we're not going to prosecute anyone with a theft under $750. We're not going to prosecute.
So, the reason stated?
They just weren't going to do it. It was like kind of like a decriminalization, kind of like when New York is kind of done, only it was, you know, 3-4 years earlier. And it's like, what were people doing? They would go to CVS's and Targets and steal $748 worth of stuff. And then they would go back the next day and do it. And like, hey, like, we're kind of setting a tone here. Like, we can arrest them all day long, but like, what's going to happen like on the long part? Like, I can't tell you how many times I've arrested people on anchor monitors and they're on bond for murder.
But the impacts on law enforcement, it not only do you become lethargic, you become disengaged. It's almost like, why? Why should I even get out of my car, or why should I even?
That's kind of like the problem where we're really seeing it. We always focus on policing. Like, the police aren't doing anything. It's like, man, I got a cost benefit analysis. Like, I got a career here. Like, not only do I got to think on like a safety aspect, like, I got to think career safety,
kids, family.
Yeah. All that, you know, and then like one bad thing goes wrong. And now the discipline process and accountability, I think that's something that we've really gotten wrong recently that's where it's like the upper level management of leadership is the big push is accountability. And they've equated that to discipline versus like, hey, your uniform's not in. and regulations. You understand that there's a standard reset. Could you make sure that I don't have to ask you that again? Like, that's accountability. And nothing goes in there. And a lot of places it starts like that, but then when it's the repetitiveness, and especially at larger agencies, now we have blanket policies, and those are the ones, like, the axe just gets fallen on the hammer, and next
public,
thing you know.
Public execution.
Oh, man, and it's just blanketed, and it's under the guise of, well, we're just holding people accountable. And it's like, well, if you have to hold this many people accountable, at what point are the people above them, like, there's an issue? Like, it doesn't always just fall on the lowest person. Like, what's the middle part? You know, just like in the Marine Corps, like, if you have a sergeant who continues, like, his junior Marines are constantly in trouble, at some point you're like, hey, Sergeant, like, you are in trouble. Like, these are your Marines. Like, we're, like, I'm crushing you now, you know? And then that's how it starts to roll downhill. But at some point, like, we're not always all responsible. We have the outliers. Like, there's bad cops. Like, if it's anything in policing, that I've learned is that nefarious and ill intentions is in every demographic. It doesn't matter. We focus a lot on, like, lower income areas, because that's where, like, the sexy stuff that gets put in movies, you know, the foot chases and things mm-hmm. like that. But I can't tell you how many gross crimes that are happening in suburban your neighbor's house, and you just don't know it. And it goes and just silenced, and it's in there. And those are the sickest ones. Because they look like you and I. Like, what does crime look like? And that's the hardest part when you teach someone. It's like, what's a bad guy look like? Like, this isn't Sims. Like, we don't have things above our heads that say, like, it's it. Like,
they come in all shapes, sizes, colors.
Yeah,
Well, I'll tell you this. You know, I do like Fort Worth. There's just something about Fort Worth. And it's so funny. Fort Worth is right next to Dallas, and they are almost polar opposites. But you've got a good police chief. He's a stud. You can tell he's a good man. He's driven by
genuinely one of the best guys I've ever met. And I told Sully this right before I introduced him, when he had made a site survey.
And Sully has been on the podcast. Andrew Sullivan, retired SEAL, now leading C1.
Community First Project. Is his deal. Great supporter with that. I'm trying to actually bring him down to do some work with us. But when I introduced him, you know, to our chief, I was like, listen, this guy listens so well that it bothers me. Like, and there's not a lot of leadership you can run into now these days where you can talk and they will listen till you're done. Because there's a lot of interjectings, or they're listening to respond. And he's
contemplating. You can tell he's trying to formulate. One, he's trying to assess and understand and formulate his response.
Yeah.
And there's a composure about him where the other chiefs were just shooting out comments.
Yeah, and a total natural thing, because they're in here. But he, like, what I think it separates him, and it adds to his genuineness, and why I think he's so successful, like, doing what it is he's doing, is that he's genuine what he does, and he means what he says, and he'll listen to you the whole time. He I know for a fact he will disagree with you on things, and he'll stick to it, you know. Like, so he's easy to work for, because he's going to listen to you, but at the same time, like, he has his views. And I think that he's the only chief I've ever, in my entire, you know, 16 years going in police work now, where I've ever seen someone demote someone at appointed ranks. And that's just kind of something that's unheard of in the industry, because it's just kind of a taboo thing. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't want to be,
also draws eyes on you.
Mosing things, but, like, you know, he appointed people, and then he unappointed them. What that did was set the tone. Is like, it's not just the guys at the bottom, like, in there. Like, everyone's going to be held to a performance standard in what I deem as fit. And those are private conversations, and he made those decisions for his reasons, and he gets to do that. But what I think it helps with is that, okay, like, there's accountability at all levels. Like, we all got to show up to game day, and we all know what the rules are ahead of time. That sometimes with my peer group, I get frustrated with some of the things that they say. I'm like, hey, you guys knew the rules before you got here. Like, this wasn't a whodunit. Like, no one just said, hey, it's all of a sudden changed now. Like, you guys know what your expectations are, and your expectation is to come and give it your best every day, because my life's on the line. Like, especially working in the violent crime unit that I do, we work in teams. And, like, you know, I was on a real successful team, and, you know, I'm promoted, so I've moved somewhere else, and I'm going through different transitions. But the one I was on, we were so close, because we all had that, like, our team motto was play for keeps. Like, we will work with whatever the situation is, but we're not going to sacrifice on safeties, morals, and ethics. And that really, I think, allowed us to be successful because we became well-rounded. We played to each other's strengths and weaknesses. We molded it. We weren't all trying to be knuckle draggers. You know, like, we all had our places and we all could support that. And, man, we were just absolutely crushing it for what it was. And that's just one facet of it. And you had, you know, five other teams doing the same thing in their areas. And what they're doing is just, man, there's just a lot of work right now. And COVID really kind of influxed that because so much of what we deal with is youth problems that lost structure when they lost school. And a lot of parents were calling us because their kids are acting out. And they're like, I don't know where he's getting this from, but these are the same kids that are acting out in school. And, you know, and it's like, you know, this kid drives me insane. I was like, well, like,
not my lane of expertise.
It comes in. It's like, this is like, not, this isn't like a new problem, but like now you're just seeing it, you know, and it's faceted and times and culture is different. You know, that's a huge deal. Music culture is really big with people. And when they make certain music about things, they have to go out and prove it, or they either have to have proved it before they can talk about it. You know, reputation's everything, and that's kind of the decaying of it.
And just to get granular there, you're talking about anti-law enforcement type.
Not just law enforcement, just criminal behavior, yeah. You know, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not just too rap music specific, but it's, you know, it's where we see it a lot in there, and it's very impactful with these kids. You know, music is a passion to them. It's a language. And I think we're losing out by capitalizing on that and creating programs that can maybe help do that in a more positive way. But, you know, at the same time, we can't save everyone. But we only have so many resources. We're short, like every police department is short. It's like, what can we really affect and what decision are we going to make? And then when we do that, are we going to have an upper management level that's going to be able to advocate and stand up to the public and be like, no, like, this is the ugly part of it. Like, sorry it came out, but this is necessary. Our officers were in the right. They followed the policy. They followed the laws rather than pandering to, well, we'll take it under review and we'll accountable. Like, I think that's the most, that's again, something I really like about our chief. There's been times where he stood up and said, no, like, this is, the officers did the right thing. And there's been times where he's like, we're fixing it.
That's rare.
In the industry, it's become rare, yeah. Which is odd.
Did you see the, well, first off, you say music, it's interesting. I remember it was, I think 1994, 1995, Ice-T came out. Mm-hmm. He created a rock band, if you remember. I think one of the songs was Cop Killer.
I don't remember it specifically.
So I remember it was playing on the radio, and I was in my room, and my dad heard that, came in. I felt that one good. That never that song never played again, but his father was also a career police officer, detective. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, I mean, great stories from his dad, because they were, this is San Francisco in the 60s. He was dealing with the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. were pretty prominent in that area, Oakland and San Francisco at the time. You know, I think in my perspective, a layman outside perspective, but someone understanding come from the military, twofold here. One, the legal system has to be, and when I say zero tolerance, we've got to believe that people make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And they are redeemable. Mm-hmm. But when somebody shows a continual habit of, committing aggressive crimes against other people, whether it's assault, you know, mm-hmm. There's got to be a point where you're like, hey, this person is not fit. They belong in jail to the full extent of the law. But we also, in media, if the media is going to hone in on the negative on police officers, mm-hmm. they also have to show the positive. Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, in some outlets are good about this, but if it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. We all know that within the media world. And the media goes right to the negative. Because mm-hmm. it creates drama, and people are attracted to drama like a train that's about to go off the rails. The great stories have to come out. They have to be told. And we've got to be appreciative. I mean, it's the law of the land. Mm-hmm. Follow the laws. Not all of them make sense. But when a police officer approaches you and asks you to comply, comply. But even my grandfather told me, once you get to the precinct, don't say anything. We'll get you a lawyer. And that was coming from a career cop. He's like, don't say a thing.
Yeah, the rules are the rules. Like, they're all out there. I think where a lot of cops, they hurt themselves is how they start the interaction, they talk with people. And, you know, like, I think respect is the number one thing. Like, that you can do, and you can do it respectfully, and then you can dust them off if it had to be aggressive in the beginning. But like going to your point about like, you know, the good stories have to be told. I'll put the ownership on the industry and departments themselves that, you know, cultures are built on the stories that we tell. We have not been doing a good job at telling our stories and
using social media
or misusing it, trying, they're wondering why recruiting's down, but some of the videos they get put out, it's like these dancing things or stuff. And like,
we talked about this.
Yeah. Although like it could be funny to be entertaining, but the thing is like, no one is going to work for someone if they're going to feel like a joke. Like, yeah. Who wants that? Like, that's just, no, like, well, they look like a joke. And like, that's the damningness of it. And I'm like, again, that's what bringing me back to my Marine Corps roots of it is like every year, every Marine looks forward to the birthday message from the Commandant. And every year it's a 15-minute video of just awesomeness. And it just really strikes the chord. And like the key moment from this last one was that, you know, discipline will be the currency we use to trade for our trust. And we're, you know, like our mission is to fight and win our nation's battles. Well, what's our mission is policing. Like, let's define it. Some mission statements are four paragraphs. You know, like, what are we here to do? And just being more clear about it and telling that, like, we can't be so shy to say, like, hey, we did a good thing. Cause that was the thing. It's like, hey, it's your job. Like, what are you going to gloat about it? Like, yeah, we do that. Why are you talking about it?
It's sort of the antithesis to what we, it's, dude, my team, they're like, hey, you need to be more personal on social media. Am I correct? They remind me all the time. They're like, hey, you need to show more. I'm like, no. If you look at my social media, it is all business. It's the podcasts. It's maybe a Legacy Expeditions thing. Maybe it's me giving a speech. That's it. I don't want people to see beyond that. Not that there's anything to see. They'd actually see that I'm pretty boring. And I go home with my wife and my dog, which almost bit you.
Total normal dog thing.
But I've got to assume with the George Floyd incident, that must have been a wake-up call to law enforcement that, like, oh, we need to engage with the community a lot better.
The problem was well identified. And everyone's trying to make a new thing for us. So this is so I was involved in a critical police incident where my team was involved in a shooting, and it was in the east side of Fort Worth. It was a really big deal for really big reasons. Like, no one's arguing at that point, but it's, how are we going to handle this? And are we going to allow the process to get the prize, which is justice and upholding? Like, were things done correctly? And if not, are we going to appropriate that? Or are we going to pursue that in the appropriate venue, whether administratively or criminally? Like, you know, that's a very simple statement a department can be made. Like, hey, it is assumed our officers did the right things for the right reasons because we only train the right way to do things. Like, what agency would ever admit that they knowingly trained the wrong way to do it? You know, so it's assumed that they did that. However, you know, in the light of in transparency, we're going to investigate this criminally and administratively. If any wrongdoings found, we'll pursue it in the appropriate venue, which is justice. Like, that's the process. But it's, you know, when you get put into that position, like, those things come in, you got to be willing to stand and make those points and put trust in that. And that's where, like, people just want to know that it's going to be taken care of. And it's going to be taken care of right and professionally. Yeah. But then when we're wrong, we got to tell ourselves, you know, like anyone I ever work for, I always say, you'll never hear about anything I did wrong without hearing from me first. You know, you got to tell on yourself first, but we also got to praise ourselves. Brings back to the Marine Corps. You know, you read, you know, meritorious mass citations for Lance Corporals who just did a good deed for the day, but it reads like, you know, they won the Battle of Antietam, you know, but it's just the way that it's written. And I feel like we can do it that way, and we can promote that culture, and we can say, hey, here's some things that are happening, but are we going to take the time to do it? Because then again, short staff, it's a lot of work, a lot of things coming on. There's always a fire to go and get to.
What city was it? The chief of police, it's a major city. I don't know if it was Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. They said they won't be responding to calls between 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. Due to the short staffing.
I think it was Philadelphia. It was a major play. And they're like, hey, between 3 and 7, phone calls only. And when the first guy gets on at 7, they're going to go to it. Which, again, like, that's a real staffing problem. Like,
do you realize how embarrassing it must be? The bravery is like, I've got to go publicly on TV and announce this. Yeah, he's like, FML.
Yeah.
That must have sucked. But it points to the fact that this problem needs to be fixed quickly. And it starts with the legal system. It starts, and I hate to say it's marketing. We've got to market, much like the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps is if
hands down the best.
Any other
like
service
when it comes to advertising, like they just slay it all the
or
time.
Or any company advertises like the Marine Corps, they will see a uptick in their recruiting.
Yeah,
and I've talked about it before. The best Marine Corps advertisement I ever saw, and I saw it as a young kid, had a picture of a DI yelling at a kid. And it says, we're not promising you a rose garden. The United States Marine Corps.
I had that poster in my room when I was in high school. A few of the proud Marines. Well, just short something. Like even when you look at the commercials, it's maybe the sound of hands slapping an M1 Garand, some solemn music, and just, we're Marines. You know, it's just like it comes out there. And so it's like, you know, if you're going to be about it, be about it. But like going back to your thing, like George Floyd, like a problem, like solution about it. We called it community oriented policing in the 90s. Like that was what it was. And if, you know, the reason why I brought up my CPI is that what that forced me to do, you know, at an age I'm, you know, ashamed to admit, like it forced me to start reading, like, and being passionate about like in that part. And so first real book I read in a long time that wasn't for a grade was General Mattis's book, Call Sign Chaos. And it just mapped it out in there. And, you know, you get to the part where he's talking about, you know, him and General Petraeus rewrote, you know, the counterinsurgency manual. And it's almost mirrors community-oriented policing in there. You know, like you have your kinetic approaches, like you're going to have to get your hands dirty. But it's, you know, General Kelly bringing on like, hey, we're not going to win this without local support.
And hearts and minds.
Yeah, hearts and minds. Yeah. And then infrastructure. Like, people are going to be upset if they don't have a job and they don't have water. Like, we got to fix these things. And it's a three-tiered approach. And that's, it's the same thing no matter where we go, but we keep trying to rebrand it. Like, oh, I have the new thing. It's, hey, like, let's just treat people like people and remember they have needs. Like, but there's ways we can help and there's a way we can infuse it, but we got to be consistent in that.
I've had bad run-ins with police officers.
Me too. Yeah.
Everyone has. Not knowing my background, and I've gotten very frank with them and maybe a cuss word or two, which sometimes they make the situation better, but I that is human nature, and we saw it in the Marine Corps. We saw it in the SEALs, is that when somebody feels that they've been endowed with power or the strength of an organization behind them, sometimes they treat people with disrespect.
Mm-hmm. And it's like the high school bully or the kid who got bullied cool in high click. School comes yes. in and now all of a sudden he's something different. And then there it's like, hey man, like this guy might hurt you and I might let him do that for a little bit just so you can remember like the streets are real. Like violence is a normal human thing and it's unforgiving. You know, physics and violence, they will let you know like in there, like not like it was a Mike Tyson said, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Mm. You know,
the most beautiful statement.
It is. It's so true, you know, and it's kind of weird. Like, so for so long, he was kind of like trashes, you know, because of the way that he talked and like he didn't think well, you know, just a dumb jock boxer. And like, he's just dropping knowledge bombs left and right in his older age and stuff. And like the way that he talks,
he's about to drop Jake Paul.
I'm going to watch it.
First off, you know, the Paul brothers, they're genius.
Yeah,
pure genius. What they've done is that they're showmen, and they know it, and they're cashing in.
Oh, yeah.
But you can't deny Jake Paul in what he's accomplished.
Oh, yeah.
Out of not having a amateur boxing career, stepping in against some...
Putting some in
professional.
Work.
So this one will be interesting, but it's Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson. Yeah.
My dad's almost 70, and he could still hurt me.
I still fear my dad.
Yeah. Oh, dude. My dad, he was driving a tractor at 8, grew up on a farm, one of 10 kids in Kansas. Like,
dirt farmer.
Yeah. Dude, he's just, you know, the only thing, like, what I've really learn from it. Like, work hard. Hard work can get you a lot of things. But then it's like, also there's like those times where like, I'm messing with dad. And I was like, that could still hurt. Like, you know, like he can still do that. I think a lot of people forget that. Like, just knowing like you can reach out and touch someone changes someone's attitude all of a sudden, you know, and that's just basic, you know, primal instinct, you know, like the animal kingdom is no different than we are. And then you see some people run their mouth and then all of a sudden it becomes real. And they're like, oh, and that's like, treating people with disrespect. I was like, oh, it's always a no-go for me. You know, and
you just don't know where they come from.
Yeah.
It was the same thing within our organization. And especially, hey, because I'm a SEAL and you're a support guy, I can treat you with disrespect. Which, when you break it down from, hey, that guy, that admin rep over there, that intel rep, that logistics mm-hmm. rep, unless you want to start doing their job,
yeah,
you better treat them with just, you better make them think like they walk on water. Because they think that about you. Now, mm-hmm. when you treat them even better, mm-hmm. because technically you need something from them, and that's not what's driving you to treat them. I mean, they're human beings who want to be good at their job and have a sense of pride. And you're thankful for the support they lend you. They'll think you're Superman.
So you hit a critical point. So you allow me some grace to segue to it. So I read General Mattis's book and I got angry because I saw it is this easy. Like, it's mapped out. Like he says, there's nothing new under the sun. And then, you know, and I had heard of Jocko in the books and I was really standoffish. So I was like, great. And, you know, no disrespect, but another SEAL with another book and things. And you hear it. And then, you know, but then I was like, okay, I bit off on it. Got real in focused on my fitness, and so started doing the audiobooks, and I was like, man, okay, like I already naturally like someone do some of these things, okay. And then I liked how I broke it down to civilian's perspective, and then I started listening to podcasts and totally drink the juice. But that's then one day I'm listening and I come across your podcast with you and George about your book, and just coming in there, and I was like, you know, immediately, like, I liked everything that I talked about, because that's what I think is the core issue that we are missing in policing, is that when it comes to recruiting and who we're going to put in there, we have gone to metrics like, have you been arrested for misdemeanors? If it has, how bad is it and how long ago is it? Have you ever done drugs? Like, all these metrics that just cancel out a lot of people in the beginning. Like, you already have a test, right? Some people aren't test takers. Like, I was not that guy. Like, I was in the middle of all the tests like I do. Like, I'm a super average dude. Like, nothing impressive.
Exceptionally mediocre.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. And, but, you know, you still find those people that, like, find the way. And what are their character attributes? And, like, what are we really getting? That's when, you know, listening to your podcast and then reading your book, you know, like, you know, I read it once, studied it a second time, you know, memorized it a third time. Like, you know, it's the most gifted book that I've given to most people. I was like, this is the answer. I went to my assistant chief, you know, when it was given out. I was like, this is the answer to our industry, if not at least as an agency. Like, all these problems like you're talking about, like with selection groups within the unit, like how are we going to make this unit better with all this turmoil, or what are we going to do with, you know, this various section? Like, this is it. And it was kind of to the wayside.
You remember, I mean, even the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. which there is no bigger melting pot. Where'd you go to boot camp? Pendleton?
Yeah.
MCRD. San Diego.
Yeah, San Diego, yeah.
It was West Coast Marine, the first... Because I grew up in California, Northern California. I mean, we traveled, but the first exposure to such a diverse group of people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, guy from Kentucky, which literally nobody could understand. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest black guys I've ever met, who's like the sweetest dude from Louisiana. Guys from all the Midwest, Seattle.
One of the guys, my ragmate, didn't even speak English.
And you're thrown together. And then when you've... Because you got nothing but time when the DIs aren't there. Yeah. You get to know one another, and hey, where are you from, man? Where's your family? Mm-hmm. Guys are like, yeah, no, I was a gangbanger. Mm-hmm. I was a gangbanger and hurt a lot of people, didn't get, you know, in trouble with the law. And one guy's like, oh, yeah, I sold drugs. I made a lot of money. And then a lot of them grew up or turn into exceptional Marines. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement is no different. I get you guys are regulated by the Civil Service Act, but... It's when you use red flags to throw somebody out that, hey, one, this guy's a physical stud. His scores are high. He's clearly got some intellectual horsepower. He's just not been showing what right looks like. And that's what boot camp is. This is what right looks like in the academy mm-hmm. as well. But then you got to pour into him. So
I really liked your phrase in the book. It's like, you know, you got to change your mindset from looking from red flags to looking for green flags. And that's, you know, in law enforcement, the problem we have is that we don't hire in someone who's great at PR. We fill it with another police officer who has to learn how to try and do that. Like, they're not those things. And so when it comes to that, like, we're hiring people who are background investigators, so they're looking at everything from a criminal standpoint. So what are they doing? They're looking for red flags, like the disqualifications. What am I going to get through here? Because they don't want to get something bad.
Yeah.
And so then when he gets to the academy, it's like, how are we going to foster? And they do a great job for, like, what they're given, because their goal is to, you know, create recruits, not to eliminate people. Like, we're all short. But, like, getting that mindset, the green flags, and looking in, like, hey, yeah, here's his flaws, but, like, here's the potential. Is he just not been shown how to meet that, or she, and stuff, and, like, starting that mentorship process in there that you guys really talk about in the book, and, like, screening and selecting, which then gets into your higher tier units. And, you know, like, our SWAT team, I think, is second to none, personally, to everyone else, like, with some of the stuff that they've done, their processes, their professionalism, their stoicness, like, they...
And I've met a few of them, and I was highly impressed.
Yeah.
Especially... And again, I don't want to throw out his name. We both know who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But just the emotional regulation, the emotional intelligence in this guy is just, he's level the entire time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is one of your SWAT members. Just, and you're like, oh yeah, it totally segues to a tactical moment when he's got to pull the trigger. It's void of emotion, pure logic. He's making a very... like sound decision. And I was highly impressed by that, that individual. Any former Army, if I believe.
There's so many prior service guys, but there's a lot of not prior service. Like, they just have a great training pipeline, and it's, you know, they've bastardized a lot of Deltas and y'all's processes. And when they, you know, they posted you guys on your various squadrons, they come in, they really take that stuff in heart, and they really refine it. And they're, you know, professionals by every sense of the mean, of just like, they won't accept your mediocre. Like, it's your best every day. You got to show up. And, you know, and they're held like that. It's like, you know, when an officer makes it to there and they're in there, like, they've really earned atonement for respect for that, you know, life. It's almost like it's got to get the SWAT blessing. It's like, oh, yeah, he's in SWAT, a great guy. It's like, it doesn't matter what he does after that. Like, he was in SWAT in there. But, like, you know, a lot of great dudes in there. Always so humble. Like, I never wanted to be a part of a SWAT team.
Until how many people try out here a year?
So they don't, that's it. Our turnover rate's extremely low.
Like, but what's the selection rate in? How many people try out? 10% get selected, 15%?
Zero if they don't meet the criteria. Like, really? I haven't seen a list like that, but they've talked about, say, hey, no one meet, and they're very upfront. Like, if you don't meet our criteria, like, you don't, like, we don't have to take anyone. And they've chosen to work down officers because of maintaining that integrity in there. And but I think this point, like, they've had some attrition, but, like, when guys get there, they really don't leave. And I think it's because of the culture they have within the team, and they love the work. Like, you got to work for the people, like, you're with. Like, yeah, you like the job and pay and, so, you know, whatever, but, like, you're there for the boys. Like, you just want to go out and have fun.
Do they still have to do active patrols?
No, they're full-time, and they are busy. They are busy. Like, I don't know what the current numbers are for the last couple of years, but when they were running dynamic entry warrants, you know, they ran 273 warrant operations, not including call-outs. Mm. And they probably get called out 2 to 3 times a week now. Like, it is not an MV life right now. Like, just would crush a family if you're a single dad, you know, with limited access or no child care plan. Like, some of those guys, and they still find a way to make it work. And that's just, like, you don't find people like that a lot. Because it's easy to just do bare minimum. Like, because their pay doesn't change. If they go to patrol, their pay rate doesn't change. You know, they're still, they get a lot of these things, but it's the environment, the people they want, the work. And to me, what really changed my opinion to, like, you know, what would be worth the sacrifice for that is I was coming out of a class, and you see the Bearcat and a bunch of SWAT trucks running, lights and sirens out, and they're an unmarked car, so that's not typical. Like, SBA, very specific situation for them to do that. And we turn on the radio and ask one of the guys who was, you know, out in the field, hey, SWAT just ran out of your Bearcat coat. Like, what's going on? And I'm like, hey, there's a hostage situation on the west side. Like, it's happened. Like, that's where they're going. We're trying to get there. They were way north.
To save a life.
After save five. Like, they had 5 hostages. And doing hostage work worldwide, like, you save 3, that's a great day. You know, they did it. They executed. And were able to neutralize the hostage taker, you know, for what it was. This guy had shot at cops. He shot at the Bearcat. He shot through a door. One of the teammates I have currently on my team, he was holding a ballistic shield that stopped it. And it was just kind of one of those things that, like, I think he just shot the shield. But like the exposure of those kinetic events isn't enough for you to be like, oh yeah, yeah, you're getting shot at. Like this is, you know, like this is zing, that's pop, that, you know, the, that type of stuff. And so, you know, they were all, well, what I think it was a saving grace is that they were already prepped to serve a warrant then. So like a lot of the equipment was consolidated. So like, you know, luck
rapid,
had a thing.
Rapid response.
Yeah. So there was no like, hey, get the barricade, you got to get these things. It was just, they were already lined up, ready to go out. But what I think a lot of people overlook was the countless hours of training. Mm. They're like, oh, well, you know, they don't need this equipment. It's really expensive. Like, what it was like, well, because that equipment holds up to the 300 reps that it took to get to do this thing like really well. And like, then they did it to me, it secured their funding for, you know, generations because of that. You know, this guy shot at two police officers that are out in their streets. So he had two pinned in vehicles, like they had to use a Bearcat to rescue them. Then he shot through the door with other officers there. And then he's got, children in there, like they're less than 18, like most of the victims in there. And they were able to get in and do their thing. And it wasn't easy. And like, this is like the thing they do. And they did it and they executed because they trained for it. And then it's like, you see that and you're like, that's worth it. Mm. That level of it. Okay. That would make it worth losing time with your kid. You know, it's the time you can't get back because that's the level of investment that everyone's in on. And just hearing like how they're on doing it, I was like, cool. Like that's something I wish I could have been able to be more part of, you know, when I was younger in my career.
Again, to the point, you guys don't tell that story. You don't put one of those SWAT guys to explain what SWAT does, how often they're activated.
I'll tell you, they are
why they train to this standard, why the funding is required, and how many lives we've saved.
They don't do it on like a public. They have a SWAT support group that on social media that they push out, which is pretty cool. Like they do a good job like on that. But again, like when it goes to like your not like your support assets, like they do. I try to plagiarize everything off of their processes, like for my unit, previously.
And can you mention your unit? Because your unit is so unique.
We are really unique for our department.
I think I have the patch. The patch is somewhere in here.
Oh, yeah. I gave you a couple. Actually, I was going to bring you one, but then I realized I already gave you some. we're a violent crime unit. There's about 60 of us all together. You know, each division has its own. And it started in the 90s as, weed and seed, and then turned into zero tolerance, which was, you know, like if these guys, they have a zero tolerance to the thing. If they stop you and you're doing something illegal, you're going to go to jail, which can cause a lot of collateral damage. And over time, what we look like is, you know, you get a bunch of guys driving in a straight line, all wearing the same stuff, you know, really looks like a convoy, which then looks like you're taking over an invasion, like Megan. And so it's like, okay, I can kind of see that. Like, what we're not saying is like, well, this has all my equipment. And like, it's hard to double up and still have space and to be active. You know, what if all these different things and personnel, manpower, but again, we could do that better, and we have gotten better with it. And we've been held to a higher standard. You know, we had a lieutenant come in and he asked for autonomy and he asked for resources and he was great at doing it and he got it. And we're just rocking and rolling, doing great jobs. We're not violating policy any more than what would be an acceptable range of just, you know, the dynamic application of what we have to do in the moment. Like that's what's really tough. And we're doing good. You know, I've been in multiple car chases for over an hour and never heard any lashback on policy of like, hey, well, you know, why were we doing this or doing that? Yeah. Because we were following, but it was like for the right reasons. Like it wasn't just for, you know, speeding but we're also able to communicate it. And that really goes back into, you know, that team accountability. Like, hey man, like if you're going to like, don't be upset that you were canceled. You didn't provide the information you needed to be allowed to. And that's kind of just the standard we've been put in that. And then, we had a big change in the culture. Like he came in and he was like, hey, this is standard. You're not meeting it. Gone. And there was, you know, it was like the red wedding, man. Like guys are getting cut left and right. And it was needed for the revamp. And we got refilled and in there and really created a stronger relationship with SWAT because they do a lot of the training, like for some of like the more active shooter type stuff. And, you know, trying to plagiarize some of their processes, like when it comes to logistical support, is like, they do like a show and tell with all the finance people, you know, the guys who just push paper, like they don't know what any of this stuff is. But when you come down and you let him hold it and like, hey, this is what, when you approve this is what we get. And this makes us safer. Now they feel a part of the team And like, they're just great. Like the way that they're very calculated, but you know, they are very stoic. They are very like, nothing leaves the family. You don't ever hear their drama. Another, like, it's all here, you know, and they show up and they do good work and then they leave. And it's just kind of one of those things. Like, this is what we do. Like, you're going to do the same thing we do every day, Pinky. And so it's really something to marvel at when it comes like to achieving that. And it's like, hey, we can, they're just process. We can mimic this. And we've our unit slowly gotten there. We just outnumber them twice. Like I was at a recent school where I've been in more SWAT like situations, initiated more of those than a lot of these part time teams initiate. And they're like, we got seven. You know, that's all we got. You know, but we don't have that SWAT designator. So it's kind of like we're not, but we are. We're kind of mediary. We got to explain it, but we're.
You guys are like Rangers.
Kind of, yeah, we go wherever it is. Like, it's kind of, the way I've equated, like, to not even compare us to, you know, what you guys have done, but, like, you know, we got six teams, and it's kind of like a SEAL team. Like, we're low in numbers, yeah. And we can deploy yes. rapidly. Because of our nature, we don't get to bring as much equipment, but, like, our SWAT, kind of like a Ranger battalion. Like, they're going to bring everyone, and they're going to bring everything, and nothing is going to get unbroken. Like, it's all going to be broken. And then they're going to leave. And they're going to be professional about it. And it's just kind of one of those stuff that they deal with. Now, the caliber of, like, the officers and, you know, what we go through is in there. But, you know, it's been kind of a trend that a lot of guys who have been made it into SWAT has come from our unit. And I think that's kind of the direction where the management is wanting to go is, like, have us be a stepping stone. I think if you were to get it his way, maybe. But it doesn't preclude anyone
from trying
a certain minimum. Yeah. And they do. And
it becomes a feeder, as we said.
And hopefully. Yes. I mean, if you could, but, like, you know, like, they've had some good steals recently. And, like, talking about manning issues, like, lateral officers, like, coming from different agencies and stuff, man, we're getting some guys with some great caliber. And they're coming, they're competitive, and they're hungry because they want that opportunity, too, because they see it. And it's a great tool. I probably know 15 guys recently that transferred, left their department to come to us for an opportunity. Right. And, you know, so, like, what kind of commitment are they into, you know?
You'd mentioned the lieutenant who took over, who wanted autonomy. It is a great sort of, let's call it nugget here. One, you don't get that autonomy unless you have the trust. You've earned it.
Yeah, I'm sure he's earned it. He's earned a lot of trust. He's very well respected.
But you also mentioned something about communication and, hey, you were canceled because you weren't communicating. Communication is 9/10 of every solution. It always is. And one of the things I remember, and I had to evolve because I just wanted to get authority to go do something and leave me alone. Yeah. Like, well, that's not working all that well. And my boss is in my Wheaties. I remember when I moved up to my next unit, I was so shocked by how well the guys could communicate in the field. So I started listening to the Rangers and I started listening to the Army equivalent and even our equivalent. Sitting in Afghanistan, just listening to their operations and taking down notes about how the GFCs is what they're called, ground force commanders, communicating. And I took from all the elements and I created my own playbook. You have to convey, and it's, again, it's the same thing with messaging to the public. You've got to tell a story, mm-hmm. both during kinetic operations and also back in the rear, as we say, to gain the support and trust, to get that autonomy. But the better story I told, and I'm not patting myself on the back here, but I was told to, within even my element, hey, you need to go train that fellow officer to be a better GFC mm-hmm. and talk to him about the communication, is you would tell a story to arm your bosses with as much information as possible, mm-hmm. sometimes over-communicate. And mm-hmm. and I would rather over-communicate than under-communicate. Just like you talked about veterans who come in who can have a bias for action, mm-hmm. I'd rather have to pull somebody back than push them forward.
Yeah,
it irritates me when I have to push people forward. Like, hey, show some pride, show some initiative,
some aggression. Timidity.
Yes. Yeah. But, I mean, it got to a point where I'd paint the story in the field and say, this is what I intend to do, out. I'm not asking for a response.
Yeah.
And I never got another transmission on the radio. Like, hey, Mike, have you considered this? Have you considered this? Nope. They're like, I trust him. He's going to make the right call.
Yeah.
And then my career ends and that was over. And I really did enjoy that. It is so nerdy to say that, one, you got guys like Sully and I, you know, 40 of them who are more equipped to fight the fight. Mm. I loved the radio. I loved it. I mean, I was rare in terms of officers. I don't know if you ever seen that picture. It was like people went crazy because I've got that omnidirectional satin antenna, which no officers carried because they would usually have an assigned radioman. I'm like, no, I'm carrying the sat because I don't have to go through you, plug in. I'm going direct to the commander, going direct through SATCOM. But, well, guys, Lee, thank you for coming down. I'm going to say we are behind you guys. I feel safe because of guys like you who are in it daily, where we got to go over there for 4 months and we're in it, come back and chill. Well, we weren't chilling for 12 months. We were training hard, but you guys are the reason that law and order is maintained in this nation. I know we're at a weird time. Let's put it there. And it will correct. There's no way that this can continue. And I think logical Americans.
We have it pretty good where we're at. So I'm very grateful and thankful for our base. For A good B. And there's some departments that are in way worse shape. So I'm very grateful.
This is what I would say. Guys, you see cops or firemen on the street, just go up and say, thank you for what you do. And what can I do for you guys? Hey, can you donate to the police association or this or absolutely.
Absolutely. So many different things.
Perfect. Well, dude, thank you for coming down to Fort Worth. Thank you to all law enforcement and brother. You guys are badasses. All right, guys. This is another episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior podcast. Again, remember, go leave a review. We actually read them. That's how we get better. And hey, do me a favor. Go pick up the Everyday Warrior book, A No-Hack Practical Approach to Life. I think you guys will like it. It ain't about me. It's me talking about guys like Lee and all the guys I served with, which about where or what I saw them do on a daily basis, habits, routines that made them wildly successful. And I'm still trying to emulate. All right, guys, out here.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.